Welcome to Camera Dojo, the official podcast of CameraDojo.com, where we help you make the most out of your photography. This is your host, Carrie Garrison, and this week I have a very special guest. How's that? And the timing couldn't possibly be better. Tonight we have Brian O'Neill Hughes, the product manager for Photoshop. So welcome, Brian.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
So tonight, well, this is going to launch at the same time as a big announcement today. So I'm actually shocked that you went from a product announcement just a very, very short time ago to actually releasing the product already. This is kind of unprecedented.
Yeah, we've been working very hard. And obviously, when it comes to an application like Photoshop, you know, we have all of the other apps in the suite, 14 other applications. So getting them all out the door on time is a pretty massive undertaking.
Now, normally it goes months between a product announcement and the product release. Why did you compress that time so much on this one?
Well, you know, it varies depending, you know. In the past, we've even done public betas where we put things out there very, very early. For instance, right now, Lightroom is in its second beta. We've got so many different moving pieces to the release that I couldn't tell you exactly why we chose to have a less than 30-day window. But we're really excited about, you know, what we want to let out, and we wanted to have a little bit of time to talk about it. I'm thrilled that it's finally going to be in people's hands and that we're going to have live trials. And, you know, people have seen all these sneak peeks and they've read all about this stuff and they're really itching to get their hands on it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's no doubt that when it happens the opposite and something goes months and months between an announcement and a release, people get frustrated. They're like, where is it? And it just becomes an exercise in frustration, people wanting something that they can't have. And here, the hype hasn't even really worn off yet, and people can actually have it in their hands tonight. And immediately, by the time they're hearing this, they can go and download the trial versions as well, right?
That's right. That's right. Yeah, we're absolutely thrilled. I mean, there's so much to talk about, and there's so much to show. So I like what you said, that the hype hasn't worn off, because that's a really good position to be in.
Now, one thing that I found actually extremely strange is I have never in, I can't even count how many years, seen a major product like this not hit the pirate boards all along. I mean, usually you'll see releases leaked out all over the place. You guys kept this amazingly tight to the vest.
Yeah, I was surprised by that myself. I started just before 6.0, so I've done more than half of the releases. I've been here since 99, and I feel like every single time, somewhere very early on, someone leaked a whole bunch of information out there. And I'm not entirely certain what's to credit with people being such stand-up good citizens with the pre-release. But yeah, it managed to keep quiet until we talked about it, for the most part. We did do some leaks up front, our own leaks. We showed some stuff at Seagraph, and you know, we showed some stuff at Photoshop World. But I don't know what to attribute that to. But it's nice.
Yeah, it just comes as a real shocker to everyone to have this in their hands so quickly. And for those of us who shoot weddings and things, to be able to have some of these tools right as the wedding season is starting, versus, you know, no one likes to change their processes midstream, mid-season. So a lot of people would wait until the end to go, I don't want to mess anything up. Well, here, it's really at the beginning of the season for a lot of us, and timing couldn't be better. I mean, we could have Lightroom 3, but, you know, that's not.
Yeah, I hear you. And I feel like we have a really strong photography story as well. You know, speaking of Lightroom, I evangelize Lightroom as well. I'm very connected to that application. I love it. So I'm especially excited that there's so much for photographers, you know, coming out of something like Lightroom or coming out of Camera Raw in Photoshop. I feel like it's a very strong release for photographers.
Now, there's, you know, if we go back to the beginning of Lightroom and we look at what the features were and where it was going and what Adobe was saying about that, there was some features that they said, well, that can never be in Lightroom because Lightroom is a image processing tool and Photoshop is an image editing tool. But we're starting to see some of that blur a little bit with things like lens correction being in Lightroom 3. What else could we possibly be seeing is probably a question, but that to me, that's interesting that we're seeing some of those features that we were told would never be pulled out of Photoshop.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, lens correction, that's a big surprise to a lot of people. And of course, there is lens correction that's dramatically improved in Photoshop that allows you to take a single image at a time and apply those automatic corrections. And that'll work right out of the box, you know, tonight, where the feature in Lightroom or Camera Raw, that's going to be an update a little ways down the line. But, you know, you can certainly see where that's valuable to a volume of images. You know, there are things that you want to do to one or a few images in Photoshop. There are things like selections and HDR and, you know, certainly content aware fill and paint and puppet and things like that. And then there are things that, like lens correction, where you're fixing an artifact or a series of artifacts and you're fixing problems. And you can certainly see, you know, imagine I shoot a wedding and I've got my 16 millimeter lens, and every single image that has a person off to the side of the frame, they've got an especially large nose because it's all, you know, pulled around and distorted. I'd love to just sort by 16 millimeter lenses and then apply that correction to all of those so that when I go over to Photoshop, I don't have to worry about those one at a time little things. You know, but to answer your question as to how we sort of change direction a bit there, Lightroom really prides itself on, you know, being very focused on the wants of photographers. And that's been something that people have asked for quite a while. One of the things about doing a beta program is we really do listen to what people say. We really pay close attention. So features that have recently been added, things like significant changes to noise reduction, things like tethering on the Lightroom side, and most recently, the news about lens correction, which again will complement both Camera Raw and Lightroom 3 in the form of an update. Those are very much driven by direct feedback that we've heard. So, you know, that product especially, we really pay attention to what we're hearing.
So let me ask you about lens correction, because I think this is an interesting one. Lens correction has been in Photoshop for a long time, and The new one allows a database of camera bodies with different lenses so that you get some much more accurate profiles that can be done, kind of like what DxO Optics does, which I'm sure they're not real thrilled. But I see it already in Photoshop CS5, but now it's also coming to Camera Raw. Why would it be in two places?
Well, you know, there are times when you don't necessarily pass your images to Raw, as hard as it is for us to fathom these days, that someone wouldn't be shooting Raw. There is the possibility that they had older images or scanned images, or perhaps it's an image format that, you know, isn't off of a conventional DSLR. In fact, it could even be something, you know, Photoshop's really an imaging platform, so it could literally be an image off of the Hubble Space Telescope. Not that we built a profile for that, but you could profile just about anything. Or it could be, you know, an image that came off of a scanner or this and that, or, you know, any variety of different formats. So I actually think that once it's wired up to RAW and Lightroom, you know, for digital photographers shooting RAW, that's going to be the easiest and quickest avenue there. But there are also some controls in the lens correction filter in Photoshop that you don't have in the RAW pipeline. So, you know, we've had that feature in Photoshop for a while, and we actually changed a number of things about it this time around. You know, we made it more discoverable. We actually put in an entirely new slider for green and magenta chromatic aberration. I don't think you find that in the update that's coming. You can think of it as a little more Photoshop-centric way of doing it one image at a time. You know, you enter this world, this dialogue where your image is in there, and you have a whole lot of control. The lines are definitely blurry, and there's definitely a lot of overlap between what we'll bring to Camera Raw and Lightroom. But as is the case with a lot of Photoshop features, we offer you different ways of doing things. So if you have an unsupported image format that you want to correct the lens with, you don't just have to have a RAW file or a TIFF or a JPEG. You have an avenue through Photoshop.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong here, but because it's built into Camera Raw, if you use it from there, it's not going. It's part of the XMP data, the EXIF or the metadata, versus being actually destructive to the image like you would do if you waited until you had it into Photoshop.
That's correct. That's the other big benefit of doing it in the RAW pipeline is it is, you know, it's editable, it's re-editable. It could be a smart object, and you could go back in and even change those things down the line. And in fact, this is the first time I'll be talking about this, but there are actually benefits to a feature like HDR, where if you pass those RAW files to HDR, you could see even better results with things like chromatic aberration and whatnot, because we can do that much better of a job of fixing things like vignetting, geometric distortion and chromatic aberration coming out of raw. So yeah, having that editability, having that non-destructive nature of those files, that's certainly an important distinction between lens correction in either the update that will come to Lightroom or to the update that will come to Camera Raw 6.
Okay, so long way of saying yes.
Yeah, I often take the long way, yeah.
Now, of course, I mean, there's probably hundreds and hundreds of features across the entire CS5 product suite, but for us, we focus on the things that are going to be for photographers, which is going to be Photoshop mostly. And there's certainly some seriously kick-ass features in there. The biggest one, I think, that everyone is talking about and potentially has the most use is the content-aware fill, because it's in so many different areas. It's not just in fill. It's in the brush, and it's in the panoramas, and you can do so much stuff with it. But I think people may have a misconception about just how perfect it is. I've played around with it. It's all right. To me, I look at it as being usually a good starting point.
I think that's a really solid way to look at it. Yeah. So it is a wonderful feature. I did a 5-minute video that seemed to have attracted a lot of attention on YouTube. I think we're closing in on 3 million views of that. So it clearly speaks to people. But it's really important to state, and I hope I showed it in the video, that there are times when it doesn't get all the way there. But what I like to say about it is, even when it doesn't do exactly what you wanted it to, it still gets you so much further, so much faster than whatever method you were using before. I think it's important to look at it as a feature that can at times be very magical, like it is in the case where I show the pano, where it builds the sky out.
Mm-hmm.
But in the case where I'm showing an image of the woman sitting on the bench, it's actually my wife, and I go in and I clean up a bunch of trash, and then I eventually take out the tree. You'll notice when I'm removing the tree, I actually run content-aware fill a couple of times. And one of the best ways to do it, and this is just going to be key to document this and explain it to people, is that if you have trouble taking out a large image, the best way to do it is to do it in a couple of passes. Make a small selection and remove it, then make another selection. Occasionally you make 3 selections and you do it. And to your point, what you'll find is it'll get you really far along in the process. And a lot of the time what I'll do is I'll use content-aware fill, I'll make a loose selection, and then whatever I have left, I'll take the old spot healing brush with the new content-aware fill option, and I'll go up and I'll touch it up from there. But we found that whether you're restoring a photograph or removing an object or adding content, like in the case of the panos, it really is doing something that you weren't able to do before. But it's really important to set people's expectations at a realistic level. And probably to let them know what it's doing as well. I have a lot of people who, some people thought the video I did was a hoax and that, I was showing fabricated images, which I suppose that if you're a product manager, that's a healthy suspicion. But they're my own images and they're real. But the other thing, is to just recognize that, it's all about the image. It's all about the content. If you have someone standing in front of a car and you remove that person, it has no idea what it looks like behind them. It's not going to be able to build a car. It's synthesizing data based upon looking all around the image and then comparing what it knows about the image to the edge of the selection. So I think you'll find once you use it a few times and you see where it works and where it doesn't, you sort of start to think like it does.
Yeah, because the way it pulls in the data from the surrounding areas, I had an image of, it's kind of this field or this there's a stream coming down and people are walking across it. I easily removed the people from it because there was so much randomness behind it. They completely disappeared. You'd never know. But the water is coming in and it goes over like this little waterfall, and it's kind of a bridge that had been kind of knocked out. You're not going to be able to fill in and remove that whole piece and have it rebuild this bridge because it doesn't know what it's supposed to look like.
That's right. It's making a guess based on looking around the image. And, if you have, there's one example where maybe I show a person on a beach or I show a person in front of a brick wall. That's easy because it has a lot of beach and it has a lot of brick wall. But if you have someone standing, in Times Square, that's a little trickier because it's going to look around and it's going to see a whole bunch of other people and a whole bunch of other pieces. So it's, in cases like that, it wants you to work with it a bit. You know, I think one of the best uses of it, anyone who's done retouching has seen this, for something like lens flare, it's brilliant for getting that out. And actually wired to the brush, if you use it correctly, it can be incredible for removing wires from an image. I don't know if you've ever tried to remove phone lines from an image with the healing brush. It doesn't work. It just blurs the content. What you do with the content or fill option of the spot healing brush is you drop a path, which is sort of an old school way of editing, but you drop a path on the phone line, then you select that path, and with a really small spot healing brush, you make sure you set it to content aware fill, you just stroke the path. And what that's doing is it's constraining that paint stroke just to the area that you've selected, and it does a really great job. And anyone who's ever tried to retouch power lines out knows that it's usually a really time-consuming experience.
Yeah, I can definitely say I've had some mixed results with it, trying to learn how it comes together. I have a shot where I was taken at Halloween. I had all these gravestones in my front yard, and I'm able to remove everything and make it look perfect. And yet you go to something else and you go, "Ooh, wait, okay, I see how it's kind of working." So the more you use it, the more you'll figure it out. But as a time saver for doing photo retouching, oh man, it's definitely a huge improvement over to what we had.
Well, that's good to hear. I feel the same way. I think setting those expectations correctly is great. So I completely agree with you.
Another one that I think is uber important is the new noise removal. Boy, we can take our, I think I could go back a couple of camera bodies and just start shooting with those again because I could just
Isn't that
crank up
neat?
to the max. It's just amazing the noise removal that's in the new camera raw.
I'll tell you two little fun facts about that I like. You know, one is that when we remove noise, I like to show an image that I took, a perfect example, just like you were saying. I have the 5D Mark II now, but the image that I took was with the 5D, and it was so noisy. I mean, I couldn't use anything that I shot at 1600 with that camera. It's of a neon sign, and normally, if I were to take out the color noise, not only would I not get out that much noise, but I'd lose all of the glow of the sign. But the big deal with what we're doing there with noise reduction is we're preserving all that detail. So it actually keeps the halo on the sign. But the other neat thing I discovered recently, and it's great for images of people, in the same way that people like to take clarity and sort of use that in reverse to soften skin tones, you can ramp up noise reduction and then take detail way down, and you can almost make it look like a painting of someone. So it's, I think a lot of people are going to use noise reduction in that way too, to remove artifacts and soften skin by dialing back the detail.
Yeah, it works amazingly well. I was just blown away by it, being able to go back to images that before I would have just tossed them. Well, I never throw away anything, but you know they're there, and I would have considered them unusable before, and they're printable. It's a huge difference now.
Yeah, and I think it's important to remember that, you know, while we support all of these high-end DSLRs, and of course some of those shoot really high ISO, and so it's certainly relevant, you could just as easily throw your JPEGs at Camera Raw as well. So that could be, you know, an iPhone picture or something. And I don't know about you, but even though I've got these fancy DSLRs, I still shoot a lot of images with my camera phone, which seems odd, but I do it.
They're getting better all the time.
Yep.
Okay, now a feature that is interesting, and I certainly see potential for it, but I think we haven't really seen its true power yet in what we can do with it is Puppet Warp. I've seen some funny stuff with Scott Kelby doing YMCA, and I've seen a little elephant's nose thing, and so. But where do you see that as really being a powerful tool for photographers?
I'm glad you asked. There are a number of features like that are so fun to show that we tend to do these very dramatic demos. You know, I've got an image from Safari where I take the elephant and I pull his trunk up, and yeah, it works exactly like you'd hope it would, and it's fun to watch. But the truth is, most people don't have an image of an elephant that they need to make him look like he's eating in a compelling way. That just isn't a problem that photographers are facing on a day-to-day basis. The problem that photographers are facing is the need for direct manipulation. So imagine a few of these cases. Someone isn't quite smiling, and you want to pull up the corner of their mouth. Or someone's eye isn't quite looking at the camera, it's looking over their shoulder, and you want to just pull that in a little bit. Or one that I had the other day, I took an image of the ocean with a really wide angle lens, and I had a little, the horizon line was bowing. It wasn't really because of lens distortion. It was because of, the edge of the Earth actually had, you could see the curvature of it because I was high enough up with a wide enough angle lens. I dropped three pins into the horizon and I just nudged them up a little. So we've got these really powerful ways of manipulating images in Photoshop. We've got Liquify that allows you to do this brush-based enlargement or bloating or puckering or twisting of imagery. We've got all these transform options. But those are all global, skewing things, changing perspective. If you have an image, whether it's pulling someone's hair in, making someone smile, whatever it might be, and you want to directly manipulate it, your options are actually fairly limited. And so the great thing about Puppet War is, for one thing, it's just incredibly intuitive. You just drop the pins where you want it to move. The other thing is you have a tremendous amount of control. You can chew through different layers. They can be smart objects, like we were talking about before, so it can be re-editable. You actually have the ability to control how precise they are. So I actually think it's the little things where we might not even know what someone did that's going to be the most powerful uses of Puppet Warp, those direct manipulations to make subtle changes to an image.
Yeah, because I think some of these that we've already talked about, the Condon Aware Fill, great way of touching up images, the camera raw noise removal, again, something that's really going to take our images to the next level. But I like what you're talking about with the Puppet Warp and not so much being able to move someone's arm into another position, but it's the subtlety.
Mm-hmm.
And being able to dial in that subtlety that really can make an image, just pop versus, trying to do something overly dramatic.
Right. There's certainly a side of Photoshop artwork that's, the sort of worth 1,000 crazy over the top, looks really retouched. But, for working photographers, for pros, more often than not, when they come to Photoshop, they're undoubtedly doing something powerful, but in the end, they don't want you to know that it was done. And I think Puppet could be really powerful there to just slightly alter things in a quick and easy way, but in a way that hopefully people can't even tell that you did it.
That's going to be interesting because that was one that I was kind of struggling with to figure out where it really fit in to the rest of the mix for people like myself.
I mean,
others are more obvious, mm-hmm. lens correction, grain, noise removal. I mean, those are pretty obvious, but the Puppet Warp was one that I've been kind of struggling wrapping my head around because I've only seen these big sweeping type of demos versus trying to do something really tight like that, just moving someone's eye or making a real small adjustment that I might not have considered doing.
And I think it'll be relevant to photographers, but it's admittedly more on the fringe than something like, we've got this very sort of unknown change to the sharpen tool that I could tell you about. There's changes to hair and selection and masking of hair.
Oh, I'm
and then there's
there.
All the stuff around HDR. So, yeah, I mean, it's definitely on the fringe, but I think there's a lot that that photographers could end up doing with Puppet. It's a question of whether they do or not. And for me, once we release a version of the app, and I'm so excited for it to come out later, it really gets exciting when we see what people are doing with it. Because for all of the things that we imagine, and Puppet's a great example, people are going to do things we never thought they would.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, can we ever trust an image again?
Probably less so than before. And that naturally begs the question of, how do I know if this is real? I should mention that, for years now, we've actually worked really closely with Dartmouth University and Professor Hani Farid there, who is, he's done a lot of work on how to tell when an image has been manipulated.
Mm-hmm.
And so I should be really clear that we're as interested in helping you do things to your image as being able to tell when something has been done to it. So we've certainly seen some abuses of that in the media in recent years, and we're just as interested in diagnosing those as helping people do those things. We certainly believe that these things should be used for good, not for evil.
Yeah, his work is very interesting in what it can pull out of an image, and I've seen some pretty incredible things. But since you mentioned it, why don't you talk about the sharpening tool?
Yeah, so that's kind of an unknown one. It was a late feature. There's always something in Photoshop development that creeps right in, that comes in really hot there at the last second. And in this case, I should mention that this was a huge release. We were really working on the 64-bit port, and that was a lot of work to get 64-bit on the Mac. And so things like the change to sharpening, that came complements of working with some outside technology. So, you know, we leaned on universities, we leaned on Adobe's Advanced Technology Lab. And so essentially what happens with sharpening now, if you were to go and take your old Sharpen tool, which I can almost guarantee you no one has used in a really, really long time, I'm referring to it as the 20th anniversary tool, because if you use it the way it was designed, it gives you really, really poor results, a lot of artifacts. But the Sharpen tool now has a new default algorithm. It's called Protect Detail, and that's checked by default. And when you use it, what happens is it's actually the most sophisticated way of sharpening in any Adobe application. It's better than Unsharp Mask. It's better than Smart Sharpen. It's actually better than any sharpening in Lightroom or Camera Raw. It's brush-based. It's pressure-sensitive. And its whole deal is that it doesn't introduce artifacts. It sharpens selectively. It does an incredible job, but it doesn't bring in a bunch of artifacts. And so that's exactly the way that, you know, that you'd want it to work. Because if you watch the workflow right now, what a lot of people do is they don't sharpen in their camera. Some people sharpen in RAW, some people don't. They open the image in Photoshop. They dupe the layer, and then they'll go into Unsharp Mask or Smart Sharpen. They'll sharpen the entire layer, and then they'll go back and they'll erase the areas they don't want sharpened, usually leaving the teeth and the eyes and things like that really popping. And it's a really nice aesthetic, but it's extraordinarily cumbersome. And so now what you do is you just open the image, take the Sharpen tool, which is going to take a little training. We've all been trained not to use it all these years, and it's just going to work the way it should. And that's sort of following on a theme that we had last time around. With the Dodge and Burn tools, we completely changed the logic of those. The Sponge tool, the time before that, we made brightness contrast work. So, you know, we can throw in new tools, but we could also take old tools and just make them work the way they're supposed to. So that's what's happening with the Sharpen tool.
So is this yet another reason why people really should be using like a Wacom tablet when they're using Photoshop?
Yeah, there are a number of features that take advantage of a tablet. That's certainly a great example. You know, tablets have so much more control over pressure sensitivity. I mean, they have so much control. They can tell exactly how hard you're pressing. And so much of our brush engine has been completely rewritten. And so depending on which brush you're using, if you're using something like the new Mixer brush for painting, it can even tell what angle you're holding the stylus, how hard you're pressing the stylus. And depending upon which stylus you have, like if you have the new 6D Art pen that Wacom makes, if you twist the stylus in your fingertips, it'll even rotate the tip of the brush while you're twisting it. So the level of integration is beyond what it ever has been. And of course, Photoshop uses a brush engine for a lot of things. It uses it for the healing brush, the clone stamp, the paint tools, Dodge, Burn, Sharpen. We've got a really robust brush engine, and it's all deeply integrated with the tablet. So yeah, I mean, it's definitely night and day. You know, if I'm working on a trackpad or I'm working on a tablet, it makes a pretty big difference.
Yeah, trackpads are tough.
Yeah.
It's hard to draw a straight line.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's cool, because I wasn't aware of that. I hadn't read about the new sharpening tool anywhere. I'm definitely going to have to check that one out.
It's pretty neat.
But one of the other ones you mentioned was the new Refine Edges tool.
Yeah. So the big obviously selections are a core competency of Photoshop. You have 9 different selection tools. As much as I'd love to get rid of one of those, every time I go out and I do user research to figure out who's using what, invariably, by the end of the week, I've come up with several people who are using each and every different one. So they're different tools for different jobs. But once you get to the point where you want to refine the mask or refine the selection, especially when it comes to hair, we just haven't done all that we could there. So we really doubled down with Refine Edge this time around. And not only did we work on the usability of it, so we have a new designer. He came to us from Frog. He's a great designer. Younger guy, fresh set of eyes. He helped us make Refine Edge a little more, a little easier to use. He just took a good look at it. But most importantly, there's a new underlying algorithm that's all about soft edges. And essentially, there are 3 things we're doing differently. One, we just know about the edge of a mask or a selection. We know much more about it than we used to. So I like to show the case of the best mask I could do in CS4. Then I take the same image into CS5, and I actually use an image of my cat taken with a 1-megapixel iPhone 3G. And when I go into CS5, we end up picking up individual strands of hair which is just remarkable. And then there's a thing called autoradius. And autoradius can tell the difference between a hard edge of your selection or your mask, like the cat's ear, and the soft edge, like its whiskers. And that's the sort of thing that would take forever to do manually. And then the third thing is we have this touch-up brush, and it works just like Quick Select, which is my personal favorite way to make a selection, which is to say that as you tell it the areas that you want in or the areas that you want out, it's learning more and more about your selection. So each and every time you say, no, I don't want this area, or yes, I do want this area, it builds a better selection, and it's able to vary the edge of it. So we consider selecting hair the holy grail, and we've really delivered this time around with Refine Edge.
So how many companies are you ticking off with this? Say DxO Optics and how many other companies? Yeah, it's now.
Yeah, that's certainly one way to look at it.
Yeah, because you certainly, I mean, Noise Ninja and those companies, as we need less of these tools, that can't be good for their businesses necessarily.
Yeah. So there are definitely two ways to look at that. I manage developer relations, so that's certainly close to my heart. In fact, I'll be at the Developer Summit next week talking to developers. You should know that we involve our developers in our pre-release program. They have a very good sense of where we're going. It's important to remember that in a lot of these cases, in almost all of them, and selections are certainly an example, they filled a void with the capabilities of what we offered. So we offered something that maybe didn't do as good of a job as it could have done, and they offered something that did a better job. Now, if you're in the business of developing for Photoshop, you have a few different choices. You can deliver a tool that doesn't exist in Photoshop, and that can read a different file format, or it can offer capabilities that don't exist. Or you can offer a tool that does a better job than something that does exist. Now, that's a little riskier proposition. Because there is the possibility that we're going to want to improve it down the line, as we do with noise reduction, which has been in there quite a while, HDR, which has been in there quite a while, lens correction, which has been in there quite a while, detail and sharpening, which has been there since the dawn of time. Or they can really look at it as simplifying things and making things easier. You know, there are things like Portraiture, which is a really neat plugin mm-hmm. that's all about specifically looking at softening skin and whatnot. I think that's a great one that actually marries a lot of different technology into what's usually a pretty time-consuming process. So I guess what I'd want you to take away from it is we work really closely with our developers. We want to see them succeed. We want them to work closely with us. But there are times when we improve upon our technology, and that's a good time for them to either work on a new problem or take it even further. Mm-hmm. And we've certainly seen both in the past.
Since we're talking about putting companies out of business, let's talk about the new HDR Pro.
Yeah.
I mean, this is one where people are going, wow, they finally got it right.
Yeah. Yeah. So we, I'll ding us on that one first off. You know, we had a ways to go. I think we were really early to the game with HDR, and we had some really neat technology there. But as far as usability goes, as far as early results go, as far as consistent reproducible results go, I can tell you personally, and I've been using Photoshop a long time, I had a really tough time getting the results that I wanted. And so our goals for HDR, which we've renamed Merged HDR Pro, were to make it very easy to use. I actually feel that it was already easy to find. There are a lot of avenues to HDR. You can get there from Lightroom. You can get there from Bridge. You can get there from the File menu. Now you can get there from Mini Bridge. But once you got in there, it was tough to use. So as soon as you pop in there now, you're going to see tone-mapped results. You're going to see an entirely new layout with really easy to use controls. You're going to see a whole bunch of presets, and you have the ability to author your own presets, and I'm hoping people will share their presets. And all of that is really in a lot of ways it's playing catch up. It's getting to where it should be. And people shell out a lot of money for our application, and they have high expectations, and I actually think we'd fallen a little short in HDR. But there is a place where we really stand out this time around, and we're really providing something unique. You know, when I talked about noise reduction, what we provide that's very unique is the preservation of detail. And I think we do that better than just about anyone. And with HDR, what we're doing is removing ghosts. And that could be the artifacts that you see in water, in trees, in sky, in grass. You know, more often than not, when you take an HDR image, you're taking it of something that's moving. And while we can align the different frames, if the image is moving between images, if the subject is moving between images, that's a big problem. And I think the reason that you see people overuse HDR and take it to that almost nuclear extreme, is because they're trying to hide those artifacts. And so, you know, it looks like a really simple little checkbox, but that's another example where we went outside of Adobe. We hired a contractor who focused on just that problem, and I'm really, really proud of what we delivered there with deghosting in HDR Pro.
Yeah, I think it certainly takes HDR to another level without having to go external anymore, which
right.
to me is a wonderful thing. I love that. And but you did mention one of, so you keep jumping ahead of me and you're mentioning things that are on my list to get to. And I think one of the things that actually is probably one of the least talked about new features is Mini Bridge.
Mm. Yeah, we're excited about that. If we sort of go way back in time, to Photoshop 7, and that was a really big time for us. You know, it was the migration to OS 10. It was this mass proliferation of digital cameras. It was the only time we sold the Camera Raw plugin. It was the first time it was available. And we also had this cool thing called File Browser, which people loved. But the big problem with File Browser is it shared resources with Photoshop. And so that grew up and it turned into Bridge, which could read all these assets. But the problem with Bridge is it presumes that you know what Bridge is, you know where Bridge is, you launch Bridge, you're comfortable jumping back and forth between applications. So Mini Bridge is in some ways harking back to the past because it's a lot like the File Browser, and yet it's even more flexible. Yeah, it runs in a panel, and you could run it on multiple monitors, and you can even make it look like a photo tray, but it does all the cool things Bridge can do, like trigger panoramas or HDRs. I'm loving Mini Bridge. I drive every single demo that I do solely out of Mini Bridge, and it can play DSLR videos and stuff like that as well.
Yeah, to me that was a nice little add-on. I just want to click on it, just jump over to something. I don't use Bridge myself. I'm either in Lightroom or I'm in Photoshop. I don't want to use Bridge as a intermediary, I guess. So to me, Mini Bridge was kind of a nice little add-on, so I can just browse around and get to a particular file that I'm looking for really quickly.
Yeah, I think having it in context helps people out.
But the other thing, now we've kind of covered a lot of the features. I'm sure there's probably a few other things under the hood that aren't on the big release list, like the sharpening, unless there's anything you want to throw out there that we haven't seen yet.
Oh, there's tons of stuff. I think, it's sort of a large bucket that I talk about in the end, which is the notion of JDI days. I'm not sure if you're familiar with that. JDI stands for Just Do It. And, we had this 20th anniversary, and we were working on this big 64-bit project, and we really wanted to, this is a page we took out of the After Effects playbook, we wanted to pause for a week and just focus on some of the little things and just, listen to some of the common nags that people have, speed bumps, barriers to productivity. So often we talk about the hardware performance side, GPU and 64-bit, and those things are really important, but there's workflow performance too. And so, we set out to fix some of those things, and we thought maybe we would get 8 or 10 of them done. I personally solicited a whole bunch of mail. I got over 1,200 unique requests. We ended up staggering the priority, figuring out what to do. We didn't know what we'd do in a week, but we ended up getting over 36 of those done. And so, for a lot of people, some of those JDIs are people's reason for getting excited about the release is for as big and splashy as some of the features that we talked about are, there's some really neat things in those JDI features as well.
Is there maybe a top three that you have?
Sure. Yeah. It's I would say one for photographers is saving 16-bit JPEGs. And the reason that this is important is say I come out of Lightroom or say I come out of Camera Raw, and those are such friendly places. They're really easy to use applications, and you come into Photoshop, and Photoshop can be a little intimidating if you're new to it. And if you go to save your 16-bit file as a JPEG, you just don't get that option. And I've watched people do this. They get very upset, rightfully so. They get very frustrated. It would be like if I climbed into the cockpit of a jet and was asked to do a particular thing. If I'd never been in there before, it's very scary and confusing. So now we just manage that downsampling of a 16-bit file to an 8-bit file, and we give you the option of a JPEG when you have a 16-bit file open. So for a new user, it just streamlines their workflow, makes it easy to use. For an old user, a seasoned user, it means that you don't have to go through the step of downsampling it on the way through there. So that's a big one. Another one, say you're doing any sort of layer style, and we had a really interesting aha moment with this, which is, say, say you like a drop shadow that has a particular angle on a particular distance and particular settings, and you want to stroke your text in a particular color. Well, we went out and we asked people all these different, things they do in layer styles. We were hoping to change the defaults, and we realized every single person has a different set of defaults. And so rather than changing the stroke color from red to black to yellow to gray or whatever we might have heard the most volume of, we let people establish their own individual defaults. Now, for someone who spends time in Photoshop, for someone who spends a lot of time in Photoshop, this could give them back, depending on what they do, this could give them back an hour a day. I've seen it where people actually take screenshots of each and every layer style dialogue so that they can apply the exact same thing to a different file. And so by, setting the default, that's going to save them a ton of time.
Oh, man, that's huge.
Yeah, it's a big one. It's a really big one. There's another neat, fun one.
Whoever
which is...
came up with red as the default stroke color, I mean, they should just be shot. I'm just...
Some people feel that way about whoever came up with black. But yeah, I think we heard even more voiced comments on red. That was a big one. So, there's little ones like if you have an image where the horizon line is not straight, and you've probably seen this in some other applications. Anyone who really knows their way around Photoshop can figure out how to transform that and rotate it and crop it. It's really easy in CS5 now. You just take the ruler tool, you drag a line along the horizon, and a straighten button appears in the option bar. You click that, it automatically rotates it and crops it for you. It's another one of those things where if you're a new user, it just speeds up your workflow. It's much friendlier. And if you're a seasoned user, it's just less things you have to do. So we'll have a whole list of all those JDIs. There are so many different ones. Different ones speak to different people. Some are tuned for performance. Some are tuned for workflow. Some are content. But there's truly something for everyone in those JDIs.
Wow, those are some good ones right there, for sure. I mean,
yeah.
I can't wait to see the whole list. Now, under the hood, though, it seems to be a significant change. Now, everything is geared around 64-bit. I mean, we're all moving that direction. Is that really a big game changer?
Well, I guess it depends on who you ask, and it depends on who's using it. We believe that it's a good play for Photoshop. So if you look at CS5 as a suite, you've got Photoshop going 64-bit native on the Mac. I should clarify, because we were 64-bit native on Windows last time around. But this time around, you're going to see Photoshop going there and the video applications going there. And so those are the applications that have the most demands when it comes to large images. And a large image in Photoshop could be a panorama. It could be a really high resolution image. It could be a multi-layered image. It could be video. It could be 3D. It could be all sorts of high dynamic range, things that are really large. Now, in day-to-day operations, in just normal day-to-day operations, we're expecting around a 10 to 12% speed up in performance. In the event that you have a really large image, and people have seen this in Photoshop. You've probably seen it yourself. You're working on an image, and all of a sudden you get the little stopwatch, and things just drag to a halt. What's happened is Photoshop is paged out of RAM. It doesn't have any more RAM available, so now it's writing to disk, and it's reading back from disk. It's those times where, as long as you have more memory, which that's what 64-bit really enables, is a 32-bit application can take up to almost 4 gigs of memory. A 64-bit application, the limit is theoretical. It's hundreds of gigs. And so if you have more memory, it can be 10, 12, even 15 times faster in some cases. John Knack did a great blog post the other day of some of the early results that we're seeing with 64-bit. The video applications, of course, see even more. In some cases, they're doing real-time rendering. The Mercury engine in Premiere Pro, for people who are interested in video, which these days is a lot of photographers, is incredibly fast. So depending upon who you are, 64-bit can mean a whole lot. But it's really the ability to take advantage of a lot more memory. And as you mentioned, that's where it's going. The machines are there. RAM is cheap. It's certainly prevalent. So being able to tap into all of it is really important. And on the Mac side, this is going to be the most significant application to be 64-bit native, although a lot of people recognize that Lightroom was 64-bit native from day one.
One thing that should be clarified is the only apps that are 64-bit only are Premiere and After Effects.
Yeah, thank you for clarifying that. So when you buy Photoshop, say you buy it on the Mac or say you buy it on Windows, you're actually getting multiple binaries on each one. So what that's to say that you're going to get a 32-bit version and a 64-bit version. And so obviously, if you have a system that isn't compatible, you could run 32-bit. Or maybe you have a system that is compatible, but you have some plugins that haven't been revved yet. And that'll certainly happen. There's always a little delay there. There was a delay there with the OS X transition, with the Intel transition. This won't be any exception. In fact, 64-bit is a ton of work, so I expect a little bit of a delta. On1 and Alien Skin, they've already communicated their plans. They're hard at work. It shouldn't be long at all. But if you have that situation where you have an older plugin, you'll have the ability to run Photoshop in a 32-bit mode until those plugins are available in native 64-bit. So we really want to be flexible, and that all harks back to what I was talking about earlier about having all those developers in our pre-release working hand in hand with them. And that's exactly what I'll be doing next week in Seattle, is we'll be doing developer kitchens to help those folks that are still working on it make sure that they port over 64-bit quickly and easily.
Yeah. So if you are on a 32-bit, like Windows XP Pro, something like that's not the 64-bit, don't buy Premiere because it won't install. So that's the
Right.
only Premiere and After Effects. Those are the only ones. Everything else will run on your existing machines. So I've had a lot of questions about that.
Yeah.
I wanted to make sure we clarified that. I've tried it on both 32-bit machines, 64-bit machines. I can't really. Everyone says, "Well, is it faster on 64-bit?" Well, my 32-bit machine is a little dual-core laptop with 3 gigs of RAM, and my
Right.
64-bit machine is an Alienware i7 with 8 gigs of RAM and super fast hard drives. So
Right.
yeah,
Not
my
really a fair
64-bit machine is
comparison.
faster. I mean, CS4 was faster. I mean, so I can't
Right.
judge it.
Yep.
Although the only thing I can really look at and say across the suite that is measurably faster for me is actually Premiere. I do these little video clips almost every day, and a 10-minute render on CS4 was taking about 40 minutes, and now it's taking 10 minutes. And
Isn't
that's without having a supported GPU. So
that
I can't wait to try and figure out how to justify getting a faster video card in there so I can get that real-time rendering going on.
amazing? Yeah, I should mention that, in addition to 64-bit, we continue to optimize for the GPU. We've got a bunch of new GPU features. Camera Raw takes advantage of the GPU. Paint takes advantage of the GPU. Content Aware Fill, that takes advantage of multi-core. So we have a really strong hardware story. Pretty much it can mean two things. It can mean, hey, your new machine is going to allow you to do all sorts of things you couldn't do, or in some cases, the machine you've had for a couple of years is going to be tuned in a way that it wasn't before. So 64-bit on the Windows side, that's been around for a little while, so there's a lot of those OSs out there.
Is the GPU enhancements in Photoshop specific to certain video cards as strictly as the Premiere stuff is?
No, it's not as strict as it is there. They have a lot more demands on the GPU, and I actually respect what the video team has done with constraining it to just a 64-bit release and just certain GPU cards, because the people who are serious about video editing, they have workstations dedicated to that. It's not a consumer application. We do make a consumer application for video editing called Premiere Elements, but Premiere Pro, and After Effects, they're making a bold step, but I think it'll resonate with the right folks. We have so many different people who use Photoshop that we need to have much more modest requirements. So much lower end GPU, 64-bit or 32-bit, even the resolution, down as far as 1024 by 768. And even though we can address a ton of RAM, we only require a gig of RAM to run Photoshop. So, I recently did a quote for NVIDIA for their Ion chipset. This is less than $400 for these machines, and they take full advantage of our GPU and all of our features. So you can run on a really low-end machine with Photoshop. It's actually pretty remarkable.
That's very cool. We did have a handful of questions that came in, and unfortunately, 90% of them were all the same, and it was, why is it so expensive?
Yeah, so there are a lot of different avenues, to Photoshop. There's the point product, which if you're the very first person who's buying the point product, yeah, absolutely. I can go back 16 years to when I was first using Photoshop. It is expensive. There is a hurdle there. We reward those people that go through that once by giving them really attractive upgrade pricing. And I think we're really fair there. We support a couple versions back. We give you a couple seats of activation. If you were to buy a new operating system, you'd be able to run that on one machine. If you buy a new version of Photoshop, you can run that on your laptop and your desktop. So I actually think we're really nice that way. You could look at it as, two for the price of one. If you buy it in a suite, it's certainly a lot less expensive there. We give you fully functional 30-day trials. That's completely free, and it works. It prints, it saves, and all of that. So we let you try it before you buy it. The last thing I'd say, just because I'm sensitive to people who are approaching these things from a young age, certainly as I did originally, is that we have really attractive student pricing, and that's a great avenue, and that applies to all of the different suites and all of the different point products as well. So yes, for some people, that first time around, it can be expensive, but it will never be that expensive again once you do it. And there are mechanisms to do that without even paying. And then there are upgrade mechanisms through our lower priced offerings, through Premiere, or through Elements, whether it's Premiere Elements or Photoshop Elements, through Lightroom, or even through older versions. So it's a good question. It's a valid question.
Yeah, because the follow-up to that is, why not have a more scaled-down version that's more geared towards photographers? Since there's high-end versions that include the 3D features, why not have a third lower-end version that could be at a more attractive price point?
So, Lightroom, in many ways fills that. If the question is there room for an application that falls between Lightroom and Photoshop Standard? I like to think that we're very open and we listen very closely to people's feedback. If anything, what I'm hearing from photographers these days is, hey, I know Extended can do some really cool stuff with video. You need to bring that into Standard. We've brought a little bit of it in there, but it's amazing. It depends on how many people you ask the same question to, because you will get different answers. But yeah, we're always listening, and I think that CS5 was a great example of us really paying attention to the things that people want. I will say, I think there's more. I'll say a couple of things. I think that CS5 has more value than any recent feature, whether it's platform capabilities or just bang for your buck. But also that there's more innovation in CS5 than there has been in any prior version. And that's because we lean so heavily on people outside of the direct team.
Yeah, and I mean this is actually, no offense to Stu for asking this question, but he says, is there a good reason to upgrade from CS4? And I can't think of any reason not to. If you look at the content-aware fill being able to really boost your ability to do retouching, HDR Pro, if you're into that, noise removal, that is just amazing. Puppet Warp, we talked about how that can fit into a photographer's workflow. The content-aware healing, refine selection edges if you're trying to put people on digital backgrounds or move people around or out of things. There's been improvements to the layers. The lens correction is huge. So there's so many things that have been added. I mean, I can't really think of how else I could answer that question than, if you don't need any of these new features, yeah, don't upgrade. But I don't know what you're doing with Photoshop then.
Yeah, I think there's a really strong story there for everyone, just all the way through. And I'm just so glad that we got to where we were. I mean, this literally started off as a release that was 64-bit and whatever else we can do. And I continue to be amazed that we got as much done as we did.
Yeah, absolutely incredible job getting this thing out there and getting it delivered on a really, really tight timeline. I think Amazon still says it's not coming out till May 25th.
Well, that's
Surprise.
managing expectations. Yeah,
Yeah, how about
people will
this?
be pleasantly surprised.
Don't order from Amazon. And if you do, go through the link on Camera Dojo so I get the credit for it. So make sure we get that out there. So, Brian, thanks a lot. I really appreciate your time. You must be extremely busy today because we're actually recording this here on the 29th when we're just literally hours away from it being released. So I really appreciate you taking the time and spending the afternoon with us to talk about all the new things that are in Photoshop CS5.
My pleasure. There's absolutely nothing I'd rather talk about. I'm obviously very excited about it. So I just encourage people to pull down the trial and play around with it because I think they'll really enjoy it.
And it should be up any time now. So just go to adobe.com and you'll find it right there. So Brian, again, thank you very much. I appreciate it. If you can't figure out where to find it, it's going to be in the show notes. It's adobe.com if you're living under a rock or something. This has been Kerry Garrison with Camera Dojo, cameradojo.com, facebook.com/cameradojo, twitter.com/cameradojo, all the good stuff. And we will catch you next time.